Blake Murphy of Sportsnet joins me to talk about the New Year's trade between the Toronto Raptors and New York Knicks. Is Shea Gilgeous-Alexander low-key better than Steve Nash? And the art above the toilet in his home. All of that and more is coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. And if I only could, I'd make a deal with God, and I'd get him to swap our places. I'd be running up that road. I'd be running up that hill. With no problems. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, one, two, three.
Today's first words belong to Kate Bush from her 1985 hit Running Up That Hill, which you might remember from the fourth season of Stranger Things, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and to talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, I got to have more than 4 years of incredible days, walks, couch hangs, and basketball watching evenings with my dog, Luger, before he unfortunately left us over the holidays. I shared about that on social media. Thanks to everybody who offered kind words and well wishes about it. We greatly appreciated them in the Divine family. And eternal shouts out to Luger, the premium boy. Number three, I get to spend part of my morning with somebody whose work always makes me feel a little bit smarter, whose face always makes me smile, and who always gets my dumb little jokes about wrestling and punk rock music. My guest today is a tremendous analyst whose work has appeared at The Athletic, Vice Sports, The Score, Fangraphs, Dime, among other outlets. Hardworking gentleman. These days, you can find him working hard at Sportsnet, where he has become a cross-platform megastar. TV, radio, internet, you name it, contributing to their coverage of the Toronto Blue Jays and, most relevant to our interests today, the Toronto Raptors. He is the host of Jays Talk Plus and the co-host of The Raptors Show with Will Lou. Friends, a warm welcome for Blake Murphy. Blake, thank you so much for joining the show today. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Now, this is absolutely number one tippy top of podcast intros I've been given before. I've had some good ones before. I did Fred Katz's the other day, and he tried to wind it up as well. Nothing can touch that one. That is full of lies to pump my tires, full of energy. I dig it. I'm ready to go. I even have a little wrestling mug going for you to play into the wrestling reference, a little Christian Cage mug. I'm ready to go, man. Ready to roll.
One of my uncles over the course of the holidays said something about being the patriarch of our family, and I could not stop thinking about Christian Cage talking about the patriarchy. For whoever that joke is for and whoever that story is for, I'm glad you got to hear that story this morning. Blake, I've asked you here today not only to talk about Christian Cage, although he might come up later, who knows, but because I was too busy parenting on Saturday to properly and professionally react to the big trade between the Toronto Raptors and New York Knicks. I used the Kate Bush up top. More than anybody making a deal with God, but you know, like, I don't know, CAA, Masai Ujiri, close enough, maybe. We've now had a couple of days and a couple of games to digest it all and think through its ramifications. And there is nobody I would rather bat all of that around with than you. So we will get into all of that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, no matter who we're making deals with or not, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Blake Murphy, what is something in the world of basketball that is giving you joy this week?
Yeah, there's been a lot. I mean, I like the clean slate of January 1st in general. We get to do the Raptors are 1-0 in 2024. I got my Shea Gilgeous-Alexander Lou Dort shirt on. Obviously, the Thunder win last night against the Celtics, a big one. But I got to go with the Jordan Clarkson triple-double, man. The Utah Jazz, look, they're not a pointless team. They're not quite the level of the Raptors and Bulls of, like, what are you doing here? What's the direction? But they are not all that relevant big picture to the playoff picture. Even the trade deadline, like, based on the asking price of Lauri Markkanen out there, like, they're maybe not going to be all that relevant to that. Their moment was this Jordan Clarkson triple-double. Every team in the NBA had 10 triple-doubles or more since the last time a Jazz player had one in the regular season, way back to inky Carlos Boozer days. So for Jordan Clarkson to get that, I love moments like that too, where, look, maybe you know, we were risking a little bit of the in-season tournament style. Hey, what are you guys doing? This is disrespectful if it dragged on too long. But it lasted just long enough for you get the cool Will Hardy moment, hyping him up to get the triple-double so he can get subbed out. The crowd is obviously very into it. The team is obviously extremely into it. And then the I'm going to run from the other corner, grab this rebound, and before my feet hit the ground, call a timeout. It's just, look, man, it's a long season. Not every team is title or bust. Jordan Clarkson coming up with the first Jazz triple-double in like 15 years. That was a big one for me. That was a blast.
I love that because I think you're absolutely right. One of the sort of underpinnings of this program is that you need to find joy wherever it can be found. And random, you know, middle of the holiday kind of coming out the start of the year, whatever, Jordan Clarkson hunting a 10th rebound. Who among us could have foreseen this particular source of joy? I love it. I love everything about it. And I'm very glad that it brought you joy and that you brought it to the table this morning. But as you mentioned, Toronto Raptors, break them up, break up the juggernaut Raptors, 1-0 in 2024. They finally took a big step over the weekend. And I'm interested in discussing what kind of step it is. A little bit of preamble before we get to that. Heading into the holidays, Christmas Day, the Raptors 11-18, 23rd in offense, 17th in defense, outscoring opponents by only 2.5 points per 100 possessions when they had all three of Scottie Barnes, Pascal Siakam, and OG Anunoby on the court, getting outscored by about that amount when those guys played with Jakob Poeltl. And there was this kind of general sense of like something had to give, and that sense had become pervasive. They try a starting lineup change. That's, you know, whatever, but there's like a rearranging deck chairs component to that. You beat the Wizards. Great. You lose to the Celtics. That also happens a lot. And then this smart guy that I know named Blake Murphy wrote, how do you ask a team to keep pounding the rock if things appear to be going in the wrong direction and stasis really only suggests a lack of faith in the other options available? And so, the trade. The New York Knicks trade RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley, and the Detroit Pistons 2024 second round pick, very likely to be at the very top of the second round because the Pistons are garbage, to the Toronto Raptors for OG Anunoby, Precious Achiuwa, and Malachi Flynn. We talk about things in this, through the lens of emotionality a lot here on Divine Intervention. So you see on Saturday all this is happening. What is your sort of first blush emotional response to the news that OG Anunoby is no longer a Toronto Raptor?
Yeah, man, I was all over the place. And look, I love Emmanuel Quickley. I had written about him a couple weeks ago as, hey, if the Raptors sell, who's someone who still has a level that they can reach and it isn't going to happen where they currently are? And Quickley was one of those names. I was very excited for that part. But OG Anunoby's been my guy. He's been here for 7 years. It was, to contextualize this, this is such a big move that OG Anunoby posted earnestly on Instagram with an actual caption. Over the 7 years he's been here, he has posted sarcastically. He has been a, like, smart-ass reply guy to teammates in the comments. He once posted, like, a defensive clip, because I think it was like his camp was probably like, hey, man, you got to push the all defense stuff. So he posted one clip. And then other than that, it's like, yeah, oh, you've got a Gillette razor ad. Cool. That's what your entire social media presence is. He actually said something earnest, posted some photos, went back and posted the bubble photo of the I don't shoot trying to miss moment in the playoffs against the Celtics, which I might have to change up my bathroom. Above my toilet, I have a like a piece of art that is OG that says I don't shoot trying to miss, you know, like don't piss on my toilet seat. So I might have to change that up. But look, it hurts, man. Like this,
Blake,
is,
I'm so sorry. I have to interrupt. Never change that. Keep that up forever. In fact, get a second one and put it next to it. Make sure everybody knows.
So, it's a lot, man. Like there's also the, you know, there's the slam cover from the championship year and the running back year where like the only guy left is Pascal Siakam. Now, Chris Boucher was around as well, but he was not on the slam cover because he was a two-way guy at that point. So there's a real feeling of, you know, kind of the end of that particular era of the Raptors other than Siakam. And honestly, like, look, I know we don't have personal relationships with players as media all that much, and you have to be careful where those lines are, but OG Anunoby has been my favorite guy to cover since he's been with the Toronto Raptors. I know he does, you know, the bit in front of the camera where he really doesn't say much. But I've gotten to know him a little bit, you know, off camera and stuff like that. Talk a lot about music, about Young Thug's catalog, get in some arguments or moderate some arguments between him and Patrick McCaw about, you know, which album's better here and there. Look, and he's also like a very, very nice person. Everyone around the Raptors organization really liked him as a dude, an extremely well-liked teammate, and a big fan favorite also. So the first wave of this was like pretty similar to the DeMar Kawhi trade. It's obviously not on that scale, but you know, I knew in my head that eventually I would get really, really excited about Kawhi and Danny Green. And I knew in my head I would get really, really excited about Emmanuel Quickley at some point. But the first wave was like, man, I'm going to miss covering this guy who I've written about and tweeted about it and talked to every so often for the last like 7 years.
It makes a ton of sense. And you're right to you note the lines of demarcation. Like, these are professional, you know, acquaintances as opposed to, you know, people you have particular relationships with. But there is still a like that there is a loss. There is an absence of something. There is a dividing line of before and after in these sorts of interactions. And like, it would also be within your rights to say that my emotional reaction was like, I got to go work on a Saturday. But like,
I was on air 13 minutes after the Woj. It's got to be some sort of, not to pat myself on the back, but I'm set up to like do radio from my apartment if need be. So I was on air almost immediately. It was, it did disrupt the holiday weekend, but that kind of stuff is like, I'm in the pocket with transaction stuff. I love that kind of instant reaction chaos.
Well, now that the chaos has settled a little bit, and we can look and say the early returns have looked positive on both sides. Like, this is what one of the great anti-hot take kind of things is, where you can say, like, I kind of get it from both sides, and we'll get the immediate returns being like, ah, yeah, that's why, on both sides. Where, and just, you know, to put it into perspective, OG Anunoby in his first game with the Knicks in Madison Square Garden, 17 points, 3 corner threes, a pair of steals, 4 deflections, guarding Anthony Edwards. The Knicks win. It looks like the way the picture set on the box. And then RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley combined for 33 points and 15 rebounds. They play big roles in RJ Barrett, I think, the game icing free throws, big role in the Raptors 124-121 win over the Cavs, who have been playing really well coming into that game. And so there's the sense of like renewed hope, renewed optimism, a reason to believe that something can be different. I'm interested to see your point of view on the sort of big picture before we get into the nitty gritty of Quickley and Barrett and their fit. Does moving on from OG Anunoby to you seem more likely to be the first domino in a series of dominoes now between now and the February trade deadline, or a more middle path kind of move that doesn't necessarily have to lead to more? We've been talking for, it feels like, 3 years about the Raptors needing to pick a direction. Did they do that here, or is this still a kind of middling path, wait and see?
I don't think that this dictates their direction from here. What I think it is, though, is a concession that they had gone down this path a little too long, and the flexibility that they had built in without a lot of long-term contracts, having these young guys who are controllable and will have trade value and things like that, that was getting close to expiring. You let Fred VanVleet walk in free agency, you know, the rumblings around here. I've always maintained that some of the reporting about OG wanting a bigger playmaking role and stuff like that, that was overstated. I don't think it's a surprise that he left his agency after a season full of those rumors, given how private a guy he is and how little he likes to talk about that kind of stuff. But you had also heard rumblings around here that he wasn't going to come back unless it was, you know, if there was a better offer out there, the Raptors would have to match it. Similar to the Fred VanVleet situation where, yeah, you'd love to have a hometown discount or a retain your guy discount. But it wasn't going to be that. It was going to be the money that determined it. So if you had, like, I guess I would evaluate this trade in two ways. And the first is, I don't like that you got yourself in a situation where you thought a player, a homegrown player who's been there for 7 years and is still in his prime, who you have the flexibility to pay, might want to walk, just like Fred VanVleet did. That is a bad situation to get into. Having acknowledged that you're already in that situation, I think getting RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickley and a high second is a nice piece of business for that. Now, in terms of what else is going to happen here, I think they're still at such a pick and asset deficit that anyone from Gary Trent Jr. on down on the roster, whether it's Dennis Schroeder, Chris Boucher, Otto Porter, whoever, like, you got to listen on all those guys. And if you can pick up even a modest asset, you have to do that from the standpoint of, you just don't have enough pieces here just yet. Pascal Siakam is the big swing piece, though. And I think look, everything I've heard is they're still exploring potential trades here. We've heard in Toronto that there have been offers on the table. The fact that no extension signed, you know, reading the tea leaves to me says that's either a sub-max extension or it's a shorter term max, maybe a 2+1 or something like that. So obviously there is potential for Pascal Siakam to stick around. And I think this roster is now oriented a little better around Scottie Barnes and Pascal Siakam as kind of two lead ball handlers, especially with Scottie Barnes taking the shooting leap he has, adding Emmanuel quickly as a guy who stretches the floor vertically. You know, all of those pieces can fit a little better. But I still do think this team has to be realistic about the fact that Scottie Barnes is very young, that you just traded OG Anunoby for two pieces who are two, three years younger than him and controllable longer term, and at least consider, you know, similar Pascal Siakam. I don't think this is a front office that is going to do the player for three first round picks that are deep into the future kind of deal. They are just not, they don't have the appetite to take that far a step back. Scottie Barnes is getting pretty close to ready to help a team win now if he's not there already. And in Quickly and Barrett, you know, choosing Quickly and Barrett over, say, this theoretical three first round picks package that was available for OG last year, this keeps them, they've changed lanes here, but they haven't gotten off the expressway entirely in terms of, hey, when could you be competitive again? And I think that's important to this front office. So if there's a Pascal deal, it's going to be, you know, hey, let's get a couple rotation pieces back, maybe a pick or two because you're at such a pick deficit. But anyway, this is a long way of saying that I don't think OG tips their hand either way. But I do think it's a concession that, you know, this flexibility that they had built in and maintained for so long was starting to hit its expiration date.
I'm interested in the component of that where you mentioned Siakam, the extension possibility, right? That it remains like letter of the law CBA technically available until, I think, was it June 30th?
Yeah.
Like they can technically extend him out. As you mentioned, the fact that nothing has been done to this point would indicate that it is, you know, there's whatever is on the table or whatever has been proffered is not what he and his team are looking for. I'm interested, though, a shifting set of circumstances where, yes, you remove one of the three kind of like size, like skill set sort of players, bring in different guys. Yes, the idea of Emmanuel Quickly could reorient the way that offense looks, you know, create more space, more playmaking opportunities. Siakam was a house on fire against the Cavs. You know, this is the kind of thing that makes you go like, well, man, maybe we should go and try to hang on to that dude. If there hasn't been, you know, a deal consummated to this point, what would lead you to believe that there would be a chance for that moving forward? Like, is that a realistic possibility or just one you have to kind of list off as technically speaking, it is possible?
I mean, I think it's realistic. Now, whether you agree with it or not is another thing, because Siakam's, you know, pushing 30 now. And again, there is, even though he's a very, very good player, there's a bit of an opportunity cost of path alignment and timeline alignment, even though, again, Scottie's probably ready to win now. There's also like, adding Emmanuel Quickly and how this now makes more sense is like OG Anunoby made a lot of sense next to those guys too, because OG Anunoby makes sense next to anyone. And you mentioned the stats off the top. Like, it wasn't a OG Pascal and Scottie don't fit together issue. It was a, you tripled down on the lack of spacing by adding Dennis Schroeder and Jakob Poeltl. And even if those guys are good players, certainly rotation caliber players in the NBA, borderline starters, you know, Jak pretty safely a starting center, and Dennis probably a very good backup point guard. Those guys kind of exacerbated the issues that you had. In terms of your specific question, you know, I think it is realistic because this is what this front office has done in the past. Pascal Siakam has maintained forever that he wants to stay here. I know some fans thought that maybe hurt his trade value and things like that. Not a big believer in that because, you know, bird rights talk at the end of the day and cap spaces like max free agents leaving for cap space, like Fred VanVleet's the exception, not what happens every offseason. A team acquiring Siakam would have had every advantage to re-sign him. But I do think legitimately he would like to stay here. He would like that extension to signal, hey, yeah, we're building something with you and Scottie. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And on court, it certainly doesn't have to be one or the other. So I think that's realistic. I think if they did an extension, there would at least be a thought in the back of their minds and probably in the back of Pascal Siakam's mind of, hey, what's the 6 month clock before you can revisit this in the offseason? Like,
right.
If they signed an extension, you know, what's today? Wednesday. If they signed an extension Saturday, he would be eligible to be traded when the moratorium comes off at the start of free agency. So there's still flexibility there if you extend him. I know that, you know, extending him for the sake of maybe trading him later feels like redoing what you've been doing here for years, which is kicking the decisions down the line a little bit. But it is an option in this front office's value, that kind of flexibility. So I think all of that stuff is possible. I would be a little disappointed at this point if the decision was not extend Pascal because he's part of the plan here, or trade Pascal because he's not part of the plan here, but the decision was extend Pascal because maybe he's a part of the plan here and maybe he's not, if you get what I'm saying. Like, the kick the can down the line option is less satisfactory for me.
And I would imagine plenty of people in Toronto share that frame of mind. Yeah. There's been a lot of, well, like, let's make the decision later until, because we don't absolutely have to now. And it seems like folks are pretty ready for that period of decision making.
Flexibility is great until, like, it runs out, right? Like they just learned this with the Fred VanVleet thing. And I think right. they misread the sign and trade market there. And there reportedly weren't great offers for him at the deadline. Certainly not the type of offer that'll be there for a Siakam this trade deadline. But yeah, you've got to be a little bit careful of, you can't run the clock out and reset it over. Like, you only get the 14 seconds off an offensive rebound, not the full 24, you know?
I love that. Further is to, you know, put a pin in this a little bit. My colleague, Jake Fisher, who, you know, was talking some dirt about me last week on the No Cap Room show, but we're not going to get into that here. His reporting, quote, league personnel are certainly prepared for a Siakam trade to follow suit. Your colleague, Michael Grange at Sportsnet, said similar. The view among league insiders that the Raptors are likely just getting started. As you said, there could be a number of other names that just getting started could touch, whether it's Gary Trent Jr. also in line to be, or an expiring contract in line to be a free agent this summer. Otto Porter Jr. Still on Toronto Raptors. you know, I'm
I have
on and
physically
on.
Seen him. I see him at the, he exists.
Right. And that's more, this is a me problem. I will acknowledge that. I'll use I statements, not sort of global statements. There are times where I turn on the Raptors and I see Otto Porter and I'm like, oh, right. Like, it's like an object permanence issue for me. When he's not on the screen, I forget he's there.
He's probably the best player in the league who could trip someone up in who he play for. Like, yeah, anyone better than Otto Porter, you know what team they're on, right?
I mean, he played a legitimate role on a championship team 2 years ago. And yeah, you're sort of like, wait, still in the league? Really? Pretty incredible.
He's still 30.
I look, also, I mean, as a 41-year-old, every time it's like, he's 30. God bless him. You know, say that viral tweet of like, oldest yes. man in the league. Incredible that he can get off the couch. And it's like, this guy's 9 years younger than me.
Yeah.
God damn it. According to multiple reports, you know, we mentioned the Siakam discussions. There's the Hawks that have been in the mix. The Pacers reportedly have interest, especially now. They also reportedly had interest in OG. The Mavericks, there's some questions about what level of interest there is there or how even a deal like that would happen. But those are teams that we've heard in connection with Siakam. Our super producer, John Gennaro, took a little spin through the trade machine, came up with a couple of other deal frameworks. You get to play Masai Ujiri. Let me know if you're interested in any of this.
Okay.
Number one. The Miami Heat get Pascal Siakam. The Toronto Raptors get Kyle Lowry, Caleb Martin, and protected first round picks in 2028 and 2030. We can talk about what the protections are if you want, or you can dismiss it out of hand.
Yeah, I don't think that's enough. Those deep future protected picks, I think, look, the Kyle Lowry back thing would be fun for the rest of the season. I'd get a real kick out of it, but I don't think Caleb Martin is the prospect, like quite that level of prospect. And I don't think this front office would value deep future protected first nearly as much as they would like a guy who can contribute to the rotation now and has some upside.
Then I'm going to imagine the answer would be similar for a D'Angelo Russell, Rui Hachimura, Lakers 2029 first rounder kind of idea.
Now, that's one where, like, if it were unprotected, you know, deep into the Lakers' future, that starts to get spicy. Like, that, I mean, we saw it play out in the Anthony Davis deal and what that can end up looking like. That one I'd consider a lot more. And you'd probably then look at places to reroute D'Angelo Russell after and see what else you could get. That one I'd consider more because if you're going deep future first, I don't want any protections on it because then at least it's a big trade chip if you turn around and do something else later.
All right. And then the last one we have here, it's not the Canadian you'd pick necessarily with the top pick here, but The Oklahoma City Thunder get Pascal Siakam. The Toronto Raptors get Lou Dort, Davis Bertans, Vasilije Micic, and a 2025 first via either Rockets, Clippers, whoever the hell else the Thunder have picks from. Take your pick of the picks. But Lou Dort, we're building something here. We've got RJ back. We get Dort back. You start sort of forming like Voltron, the Canadian national team.
Yeah, I don't. That one's tough. I love that one for the Thunder. I mean, there are a lot of things that I would love for the Thunder right now, but I mentioned this last offseason. I think Pascal is a really good fit there if they were to, you know, put some chips on the board. Dort and a nearer term first maybe gets you there. Bertans has what, 5.5 guaranteed for next year or something like that?
Yeah, it's a partial guarantee on the much larger deal.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably have to look through the Thunder's army of picks, and I bet there's some quibbling on, like, hey, the 2025 Clippers pick versus 2024 whoever's pick, whichever, you know, get a better pick of it. But I don't know that one. I don't know, maybe this is a maybe. I'd have to look more at the picks, but this gets a little closer because Dort's obviously a rotation caliber guy right now, who would, you know, kind of fit what the Raptors have been historically. They get a little small that way, but that might be a nice change after being gigantic for years. And then, yeah, I mean, a 2025 pick, depending on the protections and things like that, is something this team could use, especially if they convey the pick to the Spurs this year. You've got two kicks at the can in 2025 when it's a stronger draft at the top. And then again, you kind of replenish the draft, the asset pool. So I don't think any of them are a slam dunk, but I would think about two of them at least.
All right. So John Gennaro, you can pat yourself on the back there. It's only two times, though, not three pats on the back. No Barry Horowitz. All right. What is the view now that we've moved from the past to the current, you know, the present tense of what the Raptors look like now? You mentioned, it's funny because I feel like the lining up of the reporting on the trade, it leads with RJ Barrett, but every reaction to it leads with Emmanuel Quickly. So I'm wondering your first blush sort of view on it. I know you were very high on the potential for Quickly being the kind of player, not saying it's going to be a one-to-one sort of thing, but where, like, the Pacers made the deal moving from Domantas Sabonis to Tyrese Halliburton. It's like, who is the guy that could, you know, has that sort of runway from maybe been in a timeshare, been in a rotation crunch, potential all-star upside. You were pretty high on Quickly in that sort of framework. What did you like about him, and what do you think that he brings to the Raptors in now that he's going to get that sort of full opportunity to run?
Yeah, there's a lot to like with Quickly. I, you know, obviously Halliburton, or, you know, the Clippers did, or the Thunder did something similar with Shea when they traded Paul George. Shea wasn't that. He was coming off all rookie second team. You know, those are beyond 100th percentile outcomes. Those are, like, broke what you possibly could have predicted. Like, at that point, late lottery pick Shea coming off all rookie second team, you're like, yeah, he's a future MVP. Right. Everyone would have been like, okay, buddy. Okay. So, you know, That's too extreme a target, but I did like it for that purpose, right? Of, he's a guy who everyone knows is good. He was a first round pick. He's been a rotation player for 4 years, whether it's stats or eye test, New York, national, whatever. Everyone knows Quickly's good. The downside with Emmanuel Quickly is he's a very, very good backup point guard. Worst case scenario, which is a good thing. And then I think if you're looking at upside, there are a few things you want to look at. One, his role hasn't stagnated because of him. It's because they got a guy who could potentially be all NBA this year in Jalen Brunson, and they have a head coach who isn't going to play two smaller guards together for big minutes, especially to close games. So it's not his fault that he hasn't played a bigger role. And then you look at, what has he done when Jalen Brunson's out? What has he done in the minutes he gets? What has he done if we kind of extrapolate per minute basis or impact stats, things like that? Everything looks pretty glowing. Now, there is also the next kind of thing you consider is, well, is he very, very good at his role, or can it scale to a larger role? And some of the things you're looking at there, the big one for me is the fact that he can create his own 3-point shot, I think just opens up a lot in the offensive package, right? Like defenses have to guard you differently in terms of his fit with Scottie Barnes. You know, you can use Barnes as a screener. You can use Barnes as the handler with Quickly off the ball. There's a lot you can do with a guy who is going to have that much shooting gravity to space the floor vertically. You know, this isn't a Raptors team that has a lot of shooting still. And NBA wide. I think we've figured out corner threes. Like the horizontal spacing is not changing anymore in the NBA. But a guy who can bring defenses up the floor further opens things up for you, gives you more options, especially with, you know, then Scottie's working in the short role, those kind of things. Even without the Scottie component, though, that is such an important tool in terms of, you know, just how good is your shooting overall? How good is your touch? How good is your ability to navigate pick and roll and create those looks for yourself? Like, I just think that skill says a lot about the other things you can probably do offensively. Now with Quickly, there is also this really cool floater ability. Like, he can get into his mid-range package. He has a bunch of cool floaters. The challenge for him is going to be, you know, you get those floaters because defenses try to run you off the line. And then a lot of teams are, you know, more conservative drop coverage with the second defender. So that elbow area is open to you. Can you start getting to the rim? Can you take that defense and instead of saying, I'm going to pull up against it with a floater, say, no, I'm going to go through it and I'm going to pressure the rim this way. That's the biggest hurdle for him. And I think that is going to be the difference between, is this guy a starting caliber point guard or is this guy a borderline all-star point guard? Is look, the ability to shoot threes at a high level, catch and shoot or pull up, you know, at worst work as kind of the secondary creator on the floor off of Scottie Barnes, be, you know, probably a 4.5-5 assist guy as, you know, as currently constructed as a playmaker. That is a really good package anyway, especially with his defense. But if you can also then start getting to the rim a little bit, and I know people have made the Maxey comps with him in the past, but that's the big gap there, right? Is Maxey has, because of that speed, because of that burst, he also has that nose for the rim. That's the next level for Quickly, I think. And that's what'll determine, you know, did you swap out OG Anunoby for a different but similarly capable starting piece? Or did you swap out OG Anunoby and get eventually the best player in the deal? And I think Quickly can get there. You know, that's just kind of what you're looking at in terms of skill set to expand beyond what he was with the Knicks.
Yeah, couple numbers to build off what you're saying there. Tyrese Maxey has never taken fewer than 30% of his shots at the rim. Quickly has never taken more than 17% of his shots at the rim. Yeah. So that's that difference. That's that last step in terms of getting there. Now, can finish, you know, has craft and touch, and as you mentioned, but getting there, because that also is the driver of more free throws, more opportunity, you know, more dump offs. This, you know, the opportunity to potentially revitalize what Poeltl can offer you as a screen and roll dive man, you know, a little bit more creativity there, and also the driving kick for, you know, second side actions. You know, we talk about Darko Rajakovic wants, you know, more motion, more ball movement, more player movement, more cutting, more opportunities. And that's sort of that could be an area where the deeper that Quickly is able to get into the paint, the more that opens up. And you mentioned the pull up 3-point shooting, and that really is, it's so frequently the swing skill for guards in the modern league right now, as of last night. So the numbers might have updated this morning. You know, don't nail me to the wall on that. But Quickly was one of 11 players in the league this season who's hit at least 25 pull up threes and shot 40% on those shots. The other guys, Brunson, De'Aaron Fox, James Harden, Mike Conley, DeJounte Murray, Duncan Robinson, Jamal Murray, Drew Holiday, CJ McCollum, and Kobe White. So guys who are either at that sort of top tier of, like, they provide that spacing, or they, you know, they are on their way there. Like, if Kobe White plays the way he's played for the last couple of months, he's, you know, the same sort of guy we're talking about here. But the other ones sort of top tier in a lot of those areas. We've talked, and, you know, the last one on this is the starting, you mentioned the elevation from, it's not, he has not been barricading himself. He was blocked by Brunson's evolution, which if people knew what Jalen Brunson was going to become, you know, 4 years, $104 million or whatever it was, might not have been the market that was set for him there. 21 starts for the Knicks last season, Quickly averaged 22.6 points, 5.4 rebounds, 5.1 assists, 47, 40, 85 shooting splits. Just a ton to love when given more opportunity. Certainly appears to have that going forward in Toronto. Also, constant vibes battery. You know, the first thing he said when he got in the room was he screamed Happy New Year at everybody. Yeah. Is that right?
Happy New Year, man. He just walks in the door and this was after shoot around where, like, him and Dennis Schroeder were already, like, into shooting competitions and talking smack and stuff like that. It's OG was good for vibes in a different way, but Quickly being the, like, energy, the energy guy that he is. RJ's got pretty good vibes too, but in a more, like, low key way.
Yes. And we thank you for the alley-oop to pivot over to RJ Barrett, which is wild considering, you know, number three pick in the draft that brought us Zion Williamson and Ja Morant. And yet he's now, and also like a legit starter on a multiple playoff teams, a guy who like earned the famously hard-assed Tom Thibodeau's trust to be like big minutes starter every night, you know, top defensive assignment, et cetera. And now he's sort of viewed as the cost of doing business in a deal like this. Does that strike you as uncharitable given the player that RJ Barrett is now? Or do you feel like that kind of view is warranted given the player he has been over the course of four plus NBA seasons?
Yeah, I feel like it's pretty fair, and certainly not to the extent. I know Zach Lowe said on the Low Post the other day that some league exec had told him that that's a toxic asset at that contract price. Right. That's not my read on it. That's like when you look at 3 years and $83 million left on his contract with the cap rising as is, like he's going to count for 17 or 18% of the cap next year. That's an overpay given what he's been so far, but not the kind that really kills you. Like it's not that big a deal, especially if you're a team like Toronto that has only once in the last decade plus operated as a cap space team anyway. Like the opportunity cost there isn't significant. And then I do think there's an element of, look, RJ's 23 and developmentally in basketball, how many minutes you've played in high-level college program, in the NBA, things like that, that probably matters a little bit more than just your raw age. But right. He would not be the first player who was really good through age 23, 24, and was able to round out the rougher edges and become a better version of himself in that kind of second phase of his career. And I think that that's what RJ's got to look to do from here. Be a little bit more efficient, a little less tunnel vision at times. Take that defense from solid to more regularly good on a team that now suddenly needs a stopper because OG's out, and you'd probably rather have Scotty in the lower third of the floor being that kind of chaos help side guy. So I think it's a good opportunity for RJ, honestly. Like I think the downside here for the Raptors is he is who he is, and then you're overpaying a little bit for a guy who's either a very good bench piece or a low-end starter. And then the upside is kind of, yeah, he smooths things out, the three starts to drop a little bit more, and then yeah, you paid full market value on the contract, but you're okay with that, and that was the cost of getting Emmanuel Quickly.
It's funny because I'm interested to see how Raptors fans will wind up responding to RJ. There's the immediate feeling of like hometown kid comes back. You know, he looks really, you know, looks sort of good in the sort of in the circumscribed role that he had in the first game. You know, he's transition end to end buckets. He's, you know, attacking the rim. He's slashing. And there will be periods where, you know, you go through 10, 15 games and it's like, That's it. That's the package. It's attacking the rim. It's the free throw stroke is ironing out, and it's, you know, he's shooting better from there. So it's only a matter of time before that translates to spot up threes or to pull up threes. You know, that swing skill we were talking about, you know, he'll finish a little bit better at the rim, and you're like, oh, maybe the spike in at rim efficiency is coming now. And then it sort of dips and it wanes, and there's a little bit of a roller coaster. My friend Matthew Miranda at the Strickland wrote after the trade that Barrett has become more compelling as a Rorschach test than as a player, where it's like you look at him and you're like, that's what it looks like. But then as you watch it for sort of longer periods of time and you're like, why doesn't it always look like that? But then, you know, as you mentioned, there have been plenty of examples of guys like that who then, you know, multiple years into their career, maybe on their second team or on their third team, they sand off those edges. They sort of fit into the space, a more comfortable spot for them as a complementary piece rather than a, you know, the expected star there. And I think the fact that, you know, this is maybe me being a little bit higher or more, you know, rose-colored glasses, or it's like the fact that he did earn that spot on those teams. And even in moments where it's like everybody knew the thing that RJ Barrett would need is like the ball and some space. And then everything the Knicks did was two bigs, and also Julius Randle has the ball constantly, and also Jalen Brunson has the ball constantly. So like maybe there's a world in which now if Scottie Barnes has the ball constantly and Emmanuel Quickley has the ball constantly, the developmental showcase or opportunity might not be much broader than what it has been. But also a system with more movement that sort of prioritizes a little bit more of quicker decision making. Maybe there's some opportunity there. I would hope for that, because RJ Barrett, by all accounts, relentlessly hard worker, as you said, good vibes guy, somebody who it wasn't like he soured on New York on the way out the door or anything like that. If anything, it was more the other way around. And so you sort of hope for the best there. That said, we move to the other side of the coin here. I think my first blush emotional reaction, we mentioned the, you know, as we've established on the show, Knicks fan, was like, oh, not Quickly, for the reasons, all of the reasons we just talked about. But then the more logic-sided brain comes in and you're like, well, OG Anunoby seems like an awfully good fit here for what the Knicks, you know, a Knicks team that is like in that 4-7-8 range in the East. Like they're not going to be up, you know, punching up with the Bucks and the Celtics and the Sixers in all likelihood. They can play with those guys, but they don't have the top end talent level. But like, what are you missing against so many of these teams? The big guy who can guard those guys that Tom Thibodeau isn't going to yank out of the game because he's 2 inches too small. Enter OG Anunoby. The funny thing about that, though, is right after the deal, I hear from a couple of different arguments. Box score watching casuals have no idea how good OG Anunoby is. Basketball Twitter nerds have way overrated OG Anunoby. So, Blake, with the understanding that you are anything but casual and are much more of a basketball Twitter nerd than that framework would suggest, which is it? Which seems a more reasonable way to evaluate who OG Anunoby is?
So I think this is not eye of the beholder, but eye of the team situation, where I lean more toward the side where he's been underrated. Like the box score stats don't tell you enough. And if you're like a highlight watcher and things like that, like if he has a bag, he's not allowed to get into it all that much. You'll occasionally see the like two dribble toward the baseline, like Kawhi style pull up. Once in a while, I think one of his first possessions was with the Knicks. He ran a pick and roll with Isaiah Hartenstein after coming off a pin down, and two passes later, it landed in a bucket. But like, there's a little bit of that stuff, but mostly he is a play finisher, and that stuff doesn't, if you knock down a corner three, if you get out in transition, that stuff doesn't show up in the highlight reels. Yeah. So I lean toward he's a little on the underrated side. However, I think part of why he also gets called overrated at times is because on a team that's like 12-19 or whatever the Raptors are today, that is not all that valuable. There is a marginal value to some guys. There are some guys where if you drop Steph Curry on any team in the league, they're going to win 10 more games, right? There are some guys who OG Anunoby is maybe not going to win you 5 extra games over the course of the regular season. But what his specific skill set does, first, it's very plug and play. So he can play on any team in any lineup because he has the shooting of a perimeter player. He has the size and strength of an interior player, the defensive versatility. You mentioned, you know, where RJ's kind of been limited developmentally around Brunson and Randall, perhaps. OG doesn't need that space. He doesn't need those touches, even if he wants them maybe a little bit more than he's gotten them. Like, he can get his 16 or 18 points a game without commanding the ball. So that's really important. The other thing is, even if he doesn't win you a ton more games in the regular season, any close game you have against a really good team, he is getting you a couple of points closer to winning that game. So, you know, if you think about, hey, he's on a 12-19 team or whatever they are, they're 17th in defense. His defense and his three-point shooting have obviously not helped the Raptors win more games this year a ton. You drop him into the Knicks, though, where that upgrade in shooting over RJ Barrett, that upgrade in defense and versatility over RJ Barrett, and this isn't to knock RJ, it's just the reality of the trade. Suddenly, a game like the Timberwolves game the other day, where that's a two-possession game, and I know OG fouled out on a couple cheap ones by the end, but he did a really good job on Ant over the course of that game. He forced Ant to pick up his dribble and make sloppy swing passes to the other side that other guys could pick off. He was making the next pass in transition, knocking down some corner threes. You see pretty quickly how in a close game against a really good team, he matters way more than he does on a Tuesday night in November against the Charlotte Hornets in a 15-point game. He is just that kind of player. So I do think that, yes, on the Toronto Raptors and their environment right now, maybe he got a little overrated. If you drop him onto the Knicks, the 76ers, a team like that that needs a defensive piece that could use the shooting and is headed for playoff basketball, he is exponentially more valuable. So I think that's where a little of the disconnect comes in. And I think, honestly, that's where Knicks fans should be a little excited. Like, it certainly looked the other day like they're going to miss quickly. They're going to need to find a way to some extra bench offense beyond just, hey, Brunson's going to operate with the bench instead of RJ. But the marginal gain in that spot when a rotation shrinks to 8 guys and you're playing playoff minutes against the Sixers, the Celtics, the Bucks, the gap between OG and really any other guy on that roster, whether it was RJ or Grimes or whoever, it then becomes much more significant, if that makes sense.
Absolutely does. So, and
also a very lengthy and smooth way of cop out the answer. Is he overrated or underrated?
I do. Well, first off, if divine intervention is nothing if not a place where we can take longer answers that don't actually answer the question. That's basically what my whole brand has been for about 15 years of being doing this online. That's I think your point about there is the I think one of the fears was a robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of aspect of the mm-hmm. deal. Like the Knicks second unit has been absolutely nails for several seasons now, like kind of no matter who else goes in or out of it, in large part because of the impact that Quickly has had. You know, there's that stat of like, I think he's led the team in on-off differential for four straight years, with the exception of guys who played either smaller minute loads, came in like midway through, and also played a ton with Emmanuel Quickly, was kind of always the driver of that. And so you look and say, well, RJ Barrett going out, OG Anunoby coming in dramatically improves the starting lineup. It's you know, a larger, better version of this. It's a whatever, like a Pokemon evolution of the guy that you needed RJ Barrett to be. But are you then taking too much away from what the second unit is? And I thought an interesting thing just to keep an eye on from that first game against the Wolves is the way that Tom Thibodeau, in the absence of like now we have another bench scorer or bench shot creator that we're going to do. It's Jalen Brunson comes out a little earlier. He comes out with Anunoby. And then the second unit rotation, like end of the first quarter, beginning of the second quarter, it's Brunson, it's OG, it's Josh Hart, it's Quentin Grimes. And you're like, okay, there. And with Precious Achiuwa and his first minutes there, which I'm very interested in how Tom Thibodeau winds up reacting to Precious Achiuwa. I think will be interesting to see, because he seems like the kind of guy that's like just gifted enough for Tom Thibodeau to be like, I have no interest in you and you will play 8 minutes a game and watch Taj Gibson, because he's like annoying and does a couple of things wrong, but then you have to overlook some of that to get the good thing. Anyway, that Brunson splitting up a little bit from Julius Randle to then run second unit, and then OG being part of that, Grimes being another floor spacer, so they have two sort of elite corner floor spacers, and then Hart being a transition battery and like a another sort of multi-positional defender. Like that lineup construction makes a lot of sense to me, and I can see that being a way to, if nothing else, hold those second unit minutes more even. So then if you're able to do that and then get the benefit of dramatic improvement in the starting lineup, maybe you're a little closer to where you want to be than needing to make another deal. That said, the Knicks are probably in a position that, as we know, we mentioned the Raptors maybe being closer to the start of a transaction cycle than, or at least the question of, are they going to be start at the start of more things or are they closer to done? I'm wondering where you see the Knicks going from here. Much has been made of, yes, you lose Quickly, you lose Barrett, but you keep all of your first round picks plus the four additional protected first round picks over the next few years. You've got the Evan Fournier salary. You've got other matching salaries here. Do you think the Knicks are closer to, we're going to let this ride out and see where we go? Or do you think this is like step one to a step two process?
That's a tough one. It's look, if Mitchell Robinson hadn't got hurt, I probably would feel differently about that. Because first of all, one of the bench things that then happens is you have Isaiah Hartenstein with those bench units. And that's another big who can play and maybe not space the floor with shooting, but space the floor with passing and the ability to dribble and stuff like that. Suddenly those units make more sense than they do with Precious or with Jericho Sims. But Mitchell Robinson did get hurt. So if you are looking to, you know, address things like, I guess the hard part about this is that the Knicks are always, we always have to keep in our head that they are always star chasing, right? And, you know, if Donovan Mitchell is going to become available in free agency and you need a sign and trade to orchestrate that and you need picks to sweeten the deal, you know, are you maybe keeping an eye on that situation rather than pushing in right now? Having said that, Julius Randle is 29. Jalen Brunson is very, very good, but who knows? Maybe this is his best season, right? Like this is his all NBA year. He settles in as a really good all-star guy, but this was the top of that. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but those are the possibilities you have to consider when a guy is having this good of a season. So if I were them, I mean, especially with the Fournier deal and they're at a pick surplus, I'd be attaching that to, you know, one of those extra picks to Fournier for pretty much any bench upgrade you can get at this point. If you can double dip and get, you know, an extra offensive piece and another backup center to throw in the mix with Precious, sure. But even for, you know, one good bench piece, I think that they can justify that asset wise and still have enough for, you know, if it's Donovan Mitchell or whoever the star is. I wonder if they would regret after the fact, first of all, cashing in Quickly as a trade piece and a long-term piece and not pushing, like that doesn't seem to me, that's too big a piece to put in if you're not going for a little bit more. Right. And then also just like with Randall's age and, you know, Brunson being at the level he is, would you regret having not been a little more aggressive this year? So I would be continue to be more aggressive from here with them with those extra picks and the Fournier salary. I don't know that they will, given the, you know, overall star chasing that they've tended to keep the powder dry for.
And part of the consideration there also with whatever you do this summer is I think you're right that they will probably be aggressive in looking for, you know, whatever they've been willing to make in big in season moves, and they've done each season for the last several years. Whether there's multiple this season, I think it'll depend on who the upgrade would be. Maybe triple double hunting Jordan Clarkson winds up filling that kind of role. But the possibility of this summer, you know, moving forward, then you have the Josh Hart contract becomes tradable. Deuce McBride just signed a low level extension, but that becomes, you know, more matching salary becomes available this summer. That could be a as you mentioned, the Donovan Mitchell trade or whoever else sort of goes into that mix. But another factor that they've got to consider this summer would be OG Anunoby's next contract. Because, yeah, as you mentioned, I think it's like $19 million that he can opt out of, or 18.6 or something like that.
He's opting out for sure.
I mean, why wouldn't you? And if nothing else, every team could use this exact skill set, and he's in the prime of his career. And this is the opportunity to cash out on that. This trade puts the Knicks on the hook for that. This is where we have to note that one of Anunoby's agents at CAA is Sam Rose, son of Knicks president Leon Rose. So it wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility for there to be a working assumption for the Knicks to know like what the money will wind up needing to be. Well, you know, we'll say that without saying more. But I'm wondering what you see as the sort of the relevant benchmark for that kind of deal. What ballpark or what players do you think we should sort of be looking at when we think about what that next deal might look like? And how confident would you be in OG living up to that kind of deal?
Yeah, I mean, in terms, I'll answer the second part last. In terms of living up to it, it's going to be dependent on team context, right? Like if you end up paying him $33 million a year, and the Jeremy Grant deal is kind of what you're going off of there.
Bingo.
Like if that's your benchmark, he is not going to be the same offensive piece that Jeremy Grant is. He's not going to get 22 points a game with the ball in his hands a lot. Like he can get better offensively, but he's not going to be an offensive creation hub. It's just, I don't think it's going to happen at this point to a large degree. He can be a 18 point a game guy, mostly as a play finisher, and then you give him a few extra touches to keep him happy and stuff like that. In terms of will he be worth it, if you are the Charlotte Hornets and trying to spend your cap space on anyone who will take it, no, he's not going to be worth it. He probably isn't going to move the needle enough for a team that's not there. If you are, you know, the Sixers were rumored to be a team that would be really interested in him in free agency, as Tobias Harris ages out and you're trying to replace that spot with a guy who can knock down threes at a good level, defend at an even higher level, maybe not the same level of passing chops, but, you know, kind of fitting into that role, then yeah, I think if you're in a title window and you already have Embiid and Maxey and the only real cost to it is the tax, then yeah, he's absolutely worth it. So for the Knicks, it might depend on what the subsequent move is with the flexibility they might have this offseason. I certainly think if you're a top four team in either conference, yeah, OG's worth it, as my cat gets ready to pounce on the record player in the background here.
We welcome pet drop-ins of all kinds, especially in these trying times here at the Divine Household. So no worries about that, Blake.
I think if you're like a top four, if you have eyes on the second round of the playoffs and beyond, then yeah, he's going to be worth that 30-ish million. And yeah, okay, you grimace at the luxury tax cost if you're a luxury tax team, but I don't think you're getting a better player than OG Anunoby for a playoff style team in free agency, if the free agency opportunity cost is what you're looking at, because, you know, the Fred VanVleets of the world just don't move that often in free agency. So worth it for a good team, probably not returning win per dollar or dollar per win if you are a bad team just looking to spend. Like when the Pistons were rumored to have interest in him, like, okay, you're several OGs and an OB away from that really mattering. Knicks, Sixers, you know, those kind of teams, any of the top, like he'd be a good fit on a number of the top Western Conference teams. Those teams he would probably be worth a Jeremy Grant style deal for. And the Jeremy Grant benchmark is like also three salary cap jumps ago. So we all kind of have to recalibrate what that number looks like in terms of, you know, how much of the cap is it actually?
Yeah. And so if, you know, 5 and 160 turns into what, like 4 and 175 or something like that pretty quickly, where you're looking at what the jumps wind up looking like. Now I find myself, I'm going to be thinking all day, how many OGs Anunoby would it take to get the Pistons to the playoffs? Like if you had 1 at the 4, 1 at the 3, 1 at the 2, like, you know, how you know, around Durin and Cade, like if you just filled the other three spots with OGs, you know, how good a team is that? Somebody with 2K, I'm too old. Somebody with 2K, clone and sim and let me know about that, report back, and we'll take a closer look at that. Well, I mean, obviously I have a vested interest here being in New York, but like I'm very interested in how this goes, where this goes from here. I'm wondering, like, from the Raptors perspective, we'll go out on this before we get into our, you know, the spiels that we do at the end here. What's the biggest thing that you're looking at from here on out this season? Like now the context has changed with this trade. Quickly's in, Barrett's in, OG's out. What are you sort of most interested to watch develop over the course of the next, you know, few weeks before the trade deadline, few months before the end of the season, et cetera?
It's what Quickly and Barnes can figure out chemistry wise together. And the Raptors have tried, kind of dabbled in, hey, Scotty's going to run some pick and roll. Scotty's going to play small ball five in a bench unit and be the screener more often. Scotty's going to be given the runway to one-on-one and stuff like that. There is nothing you can ask Scotty Barnes to do that I'm not going to be in favor of, because everything they've thrown at him, he's done really well. Now getting to do all of that with Emmanuel Quickly, who has that shooting gravity, who's maybe a little bit more creative of a passer. You know, like when they made that starting lineup change, it wasn't really about like Gary Trent is better than Dennis Schroeder. It was about, well, a starting lineup with no shooting doesn't make a lot of basketball sense, and a lesser player who can space the floor, there might be a bonus to that. Going from, say, Gary Trent in that starting lineup to Emmanuel Quickly in terms of what Scotty Barnes can play with and play off of and play around is pretty significant in terms of your offensive options. So both for Barnes and for Quickly, I'm super curious to see how Quickly... Sorry, I hate that pun
happened. It's unavoidable. It has happened in every conversation regarding this player for the last several seasons. It's
how
okay.
smoothly they can develop that chemistry. That's probably the biggest piece, that two-man game and what that looks like. Obviously, a lot of bigger Raptor questions, but like when we sit down to watch Grizzlies tonight, that's what I'm looking at. What are Quickly and Barnes doing together?
Yeah, and the note on that to me is when Quickly started those 21 games last season, he was getting up 8 threes a night. Kind of feels like that almost should be your base. Like, let's jack that up. You know, like if you're able to get those up and get them up at a 40%, you know, get them in at like a high 30s, 40% clip, the more you do that, the more you space, the more opportunity you create for Scotty and for Pascal and for Pirtle and for cuts for Barrett and for everything else opens up. Spacing is offense, offense is spacing, and Quickly seems well positioned to provide that. We'll wrap up here with something that we call the closing five, Blake Murphy, because as a certified ball knower, I know that you know that how you finish is more important than how you start. And today, as a special treat in honor of my guest, we are going full CanCon on this one.
Yeah.
Canadian content in every question. Question the first. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, what the f***, man?
Yeah, I mean, I got the little Shai shirt on. That was a gift from my co-host Alex Wong for Christmas. It's great, man. Like, as high as everyone's been on Shai here in Canada for a long time, and like I got to know him a little bit when he was on his way up as a teen, and like obviously very good person. The game is super fun. To have to kick around the question of, is he better than Steve Nash was in his two MVP years is wild. Like if you told me that 2 years ago, I'd have been like, this is overreaction. Like, get off of Twitter, get off of Reddit. Like, this is too much. This is blasphemy. And then he went out and had a legitimate top five MVP season, led the Canadian men to their first ever medal in the FIBA World Cup, and entered the season even better than before. He might be the most, not physically, but in terms of craft and things like that, he might be the most difficult guy to guard one-on-one in a like face-up perimeter situation in basketball right now, short of maybe Steph and Kyrie and Dame, the kind of handles and step back class of guy. There is nothing Shai can't really do offensively. Four level scorer. He's improved a lot defensively. He's made room for Chet and J-Dub there to get their growth and their offense in around what he does. I think he's probably top three on most MVP ballots right now, which, again, when he was fifth last year and made first team All-NBA, Steve Nash, the only other Canadian to ever do that, the only other Canadian to ever get an MVP vote. was Steve Nash. So this is really exciting for Shea, for the Thunder, who beat the Celtics last night and just keeps stacking statement wins up. And this is like too early, probably, but like 2024 Paris Olympics, it's really exciting too, because, you know, if you go into that tournament feeling like you have the best player in a lot of those games, that is that makes you feel pretty good about the chance to repeat on the podium for Canada, even if the U.S. sends a better team this time around.
Which, I mean, selfishly, I certainly hope is the case. Before this season, the list of players who average better than 30 points, 5 rebounds, and 5 assists a game on 625 true shooting. I admit, we're slicing the onion a little thin here, but basically 35-5 on elite true shooting. Kevin Durant, 2012-13. Steph, 2015-16. You might note that both of those guys won MVP. James Harden, 2019-20, third in MVP voting. Steph again, 2020-21, third in MVP voting. This is what Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is doing this year while also leading the league in steals. So it is sickening. You mentioned the might be the hardest guy to deal with and stay in front of in the league. Look no further than asking Drew Holiday and Derek White, who could not do that. The best defensive backcourt in the NBA had zero zip for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander.
They had to put Tatum on him down the stretch, right? Switch that and, you know, funnel it through Jaylen.
And yeah, exactly. When the Thunder had an answer for that, which pretty impressive. So sub question, SGA Canadian, Lou Dort, Chet, I mean, listen, Minnesota is basically Alberta, right? So can the Thunder technically be claimed as Canada's second team?
Yeah, I think pretty safely. We've kicked that around in the past of, you know, what, like, obviously every Canadian basketball fan and Raptors fan cheered for the Steve Nash Suns. Like, I don't find me a person who is a fan of basketball in Canada and didn't root for those teams, and I'll point you to a liar or someone who was like 9 years old at the time. So yeah, I think absolutely you can get behind them. I think I certainly got the feeling maybe this is an insulation from basketball Twitter or whatever, or being from the same hometown as Jamal Murray. Certainly felt like the Nuggets got that last year because of the Jamal Murray component. And now you've got Shea and Dort, and, you know, they're kind of the darlings right now. It's a lot of fun. And also I would say to Canadian fans, get in the whole, like, I have a second team because of Canadians thing. Get it in now, because there are like 23 Canadians in the NBA. Soon it's going to be like, well, yeah, you could pick any team in the league. That's not fair. The Blazers are your team because of Shaedon Sharpe, you know?
I like that. Especially, like, this is a really, it's not a ground floor opportunity. You can get in at the penthouse. Like, this Thunder team is worth investing that kind of love and affection in. And especially, is that really a competitive feeling? Like, well, the Raptors are working through some stuff. Let's stay in the interest of a high level competitive basketball deep into the spring and summer. Speaking of summer basketball, you just mentioned this past summer's FIBA. So question number two officially. This past summer's FIBA World Cup, Team Canada arrives legitimate men's international power. A hard-fought loss to Serbia in the semifinal, defeats Team USA in the third-place game, qualifies for the Olympics for the first time since 2000. Blake Murphy, look into the crystal ball. Where does Team Canada finish in Paris in 2024?
So I did a bold predictions for 2024 piece the other week, and it was mostly NBA-focused. But my bold prediction on the international side was that Canada double-dips on the podium because the Canadian women have been way ahead of the men in terms of international success for a long time, but they haven't hit the podium. They finished fourth at an Olympics before. I think they finished fourth in the World Cup before, but they haven't quite got there. They're the number five ranked program. So my prediction was they both get bronze. Now, Canada, I think, obviously has an even higher upside than that if everyone shows up. One of the small issues with projecting Canada to be higher than that is that we just mentioned Shea and Jamal. There could be some guys going on long playoff runs, and the Olympics are sooner after the end of the postseason, which is good for most guys because it structures your offseason a little better and you don't have to go right from, you know, China into training camp like they did in 2019. But those guys who went on long playoff runs may be a little less available. So I'm going to say double bronze.
I love that. I also love that you've sort of one downsman to yourself there. You've established a floor and then you've provided yourself the opportunity for an upside emotional lift if and when they go higher than that. Question number three. You are not the first guest in Divine Intervention's brief history to have appeared in a music video. Shouts out to Josh Gondelman's performance in Speedy Ortiz's Ghostwriter. But you did play a bailiff in the video for Totally Fine by the wonderful Toronto band Pup off their 2002 record, The Unraveling of Pup the Band. Big fan of Pup here at Divine Intervention. My question to you is, what was it like playing a sworn officer of the law, and how did this happen?
Well, it happened because the guys in Pup are some of my best friends. So, like, I'm watching the Raptor game with Steve, their guitarist, on Friday. I watched a Canadian World Junior hockey. This is the most Canadian sentence I'll ever say. Middle of the afternoon the other day, I went to the bar to watch the Canadian World Junior national hockey team play a game with Stefan, the lead singer. So they're good friends of mine. And it was kind of like, they were doing it. They were shooting the video in Hamilton, so not that far. You know, they are getting bigger, but you only have so much budget, and if you can tag in some friends to be in the music video, so be it. So yeah, it was cool. It was like at this it used to be like a factory, and now it's just kind of an abandoned space that they use for TV shows and music videos and things like that in Hamilton. It was freezing. There was no heat there. So like in between scenes, there's like, even in some of the shots, you could see like the steam coming off her breath.
Yes, I have that down in my notes. It looked like it was freezing, and you can see everybody's breath in the courtroom scene.
Yeah, so everyone's like bundled up in between takes and stuff like that. My job was really easy because like I just stood there the whole time. Like there was stuff that got cut where like I had to walk each member up and fake swear them in and things like that. You know, Stefan, the singer, when he does his big final speech during the bridge, you know, everyone in the courtroom is like going from being angry at him to like getting it and like borderline tears and stuff like that. So that was fun to do. There's also like, there's another scene where I play a cop, which ACAB obviously, but except for me, where I have to arrest Zach, the drummer, and just like push the camera out of the way. And so it was a lot of fun. It was just one day. I still did at that point I was on the morning show here. So I was done at like 10 a.m. booked it to Hamilton. It was a one day thing. It was so much fun. I don't know that I would do it regularly, like a whole day being freezing cold, shooting the same thing over and over again for no pay. But it was very cool as a one time thing.
Well, I feel like we, for 2024, we can speak into the universe. Some pay, more frequent opportunities for you on camera acting.
I don't
roles
even need the pay. Just let me like. Let me act then, you know, let me have a role. There's like they have a music video from back in the day where it's choose your own adventure style. You can go on YouTube and you can play it. And in one of the scenarios you go down, Steve gets beaten up at the end. And like, come on, I couldn't be the guy that kicks Steve's ass in a music video. Like I was born to play that. That's the kind of role I need next.
See, what I love about that is that you're looking to not get typecast. You don't just want to be an officer of the law. You also want to be the criminal element. And
yes,
I think that's
the
a good,
law and the outlaw.
That's exactly right. The dichotomy of man, really, in the space of Blake Murphy and music videos. Question number four. As I alluded to earlier, you are a fan of professional wrestling. Who is your favorite Canadian pro wrestler of all time?
Of all time, it's Bret Hart. I don't know. There's
correct.
Really any touching him. Grew up on him. You know, read his biography when I was younger and stuff like that. There's no touching Bret Hart. Historically, I've been a big Jericho guy. Off court,
maybe not this
stuff,
week.
Yeah, off court stuff has maybe dragged that down a little bit. Current batch, I would say. So I got a little Christian Cage mug here of Outwork Everyone. I mean, I don't know that anyone's doing the like promo and character work that he is right now. So Bret Hart all time, Christian Cage killing it right now. I went as Kevin Owens for Halloween. I don't know if you could picture with a longer beard and the sleeves cut off here. A very easy Halloween costume for me.
Good choices all the way around. Question number five. You co-host a music podcast called Columbia House Party, where you and Jake Goldsby chat about bands and albums. What is the most appropriate musical accompaniment for finding out some other guy's on the private jet and that actually Otani's signing with the Dodgers, not the Jays?
Ooh, the music, man, I wish I had prepped for this one a little bit more. Okay, just because we're going Canadian with this, and I'm on the spot, I'm gonna go with Left and Leaving by the Weaker Thens. I just that kind of wistful, where
it's
are you
answer.
I will be here waiting kind of thing. I'm sure there are better, like sadder answers, but the Canadian, to stick with the Canadiana, I'll go with that one.
That's the correct answer, Blake. You went 5 for 5. You absolutely nailed
Perfect.
It there. And the last thing we do before we get out of town is a weekly recommendation. It does not have to be anything about basketball, something that is cool and good that you like and think the people will like as well. Blake Murphy.
So I was going to say New Japan Pro Wrestling's Wrestle Kingdom is tomorrow. That's their version of WrestleMania, but I don't know if I'd sell anyone on that. So I know someone already did an album earlier on one of the episodes. They did Wednesday's Rat Saw God, which is a terrific album.
Right. Shout out to Chris Harrington on last week's episode about the Grizzlies. Go back, check that one out.
So I'm going to go back-to-back music recommendations here. It is the start of the new year, so we all did our year-end lists and things like that. And it is slightly basketball-adjacent. So the album I'm going to recommend is an album called Hometown Hero by a Chicago artist named Warm Human. The cover of that album is someone hanging off the rim in like a rundown like park hoop, which is cool. It is an album that it made my like year-end list, but it's probably from the time I dropped that list to now the album that I've listened to most and would have risen the most if I waited to December 31st, like we reasonably should for year-end lists. It can be a bit of a downer album, as I'm wont to do, but I feel like it very, very much nails a sort of empathetic feel of like, so it's a breakup album, but it's very much about those situations where, whether it's friendship or romantic relationship, whatever, where you feel this level of connectedness with someone and almost like a shared history, or there's enough overlap in the history. Like I've used the term sister cities in the past. It's something the Wonder Years used to kind of describe this feeling years and years ago, where there is just a recognition in another person that you have been through similar things and can understand each other on a level because of those kind of not shared experience, but kind of parallel experiences. And I think the album really, really hits that feeling really, really well, on top of just being a very good album and having the cool Slam Dunk cover.
I love that. Warm Human, Hometown Hero. You can find that on Bandcamp, everywhere else that albums are sold and streamed. I would suggest that as well. My recommendation this week, empathy plays a big role in this one too. It's the novel Hell is a World Without You by Jason Kirk. Jason Kirk is a longtime veteran of the sports internet. Folks might know him as the former college football editor at SB Nation. He's one of the co-hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, one of my favorite things that exists. This is his first novel, and I had pre-ordered it because he said it was supposed to come out in February, and then something happened that went wrong, I guess, and they started showing up early, and it got here before Christmas, and I tore through it. Absolutely couldn't put it down. It's a novel about kids coming of age in the world of fundamental Christianity in the South part of America, trying to figure out, you know, who and what they believe, who and what they want to be, whether that's different from what their folks and the adults did in their lives have sort of shown them, and, you know, how that lines up with the things that they've learned. It's not my experience. I'm a lapsed Brooklyn Irish Catholic, but there is a lot to recognize and to empathize with. And a lot of that goes to just how clear-eyed and warm and really funny Jason's writing was. So I found it absolutely delightful, particularly if maybe you were a teenager around the turn of the 21st century, that might hit you in a certain spot there. I can't recommend it enough. And I'm very glad that whatever happened that went wrong with the pre-orders, it got to me early. Also, just for shouts to that, proceeds for orders before February 12th are going to go to the Trevor Project, which is a very cool thing and a nice, easy way to do some good in the world and then get a book that's fun to read. So Hell is a World Without You by Jason Kirk, wherever books are found and sold. And that's going to do it for us this week, Blake. Anything else that we can point people toward on the way out the door? Where can people find your work, etc.?
No, that book sounds great. Like you, I grew up Catholic and I'm not particularly practicing anymore, but it sounds fascinating. And the Trevor Project's a great cause as well. I'll just echo that. I have a CM Punk Trevor Project shirt just to really highlight how big a nerd I am. Let's go into the wrestling gear.
We're tying a lot of strands together here, and I like that.
Yeah. That's pretty much it, man. Really appreciate you having me on. I mean, people can check out the show on Sportsnet with me and Will Liu and Alex Wong and you again in the future, I'm sure.
You can find Blake also on social media, Blake Murphy ODC, if you want to find links to those things and where you can find him as well. That's going to do it for us on this episode of Divine Intervention. Thanks so much to Blake Murphy for taking all this time to be with us and to reconnect with himself. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you've enjoyed the show, do me a favor, go to the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed, wherever you're listening to consuming this. Rate, review, like, say something nice about it, tell a friend about it. Helps with discoverability and growing the show. And that's going to do it for us. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.